everybody. Welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I am your host, Phil Drew, Administrator. It's a beautiful day here in Austin, Texas. And I have on the phone from Washington, D.C., or somewhere thereabouts, according to the area code anyway, Beverly Ekman. She is the author of Educating for the New World Order, Microchipped, How the Education Establishment Took Us Beyond Big Brother, and Cloning the American Mind, Eradicating Morality Through Education, for which she won the International Human Rights Award. Mrs. Ekman is a former teacher, speechwriter for U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice Warren Burger, a technical writer and researcher. She is the president of the United States National Education Consortium. Welcome to the show, Mrs. Ekman.
My pleasure.
Wow, so you won an International Human Rights Award. Tell us about that. And then maybe a little bit about how you got started investigating this topic.
Well, the International Human Rights Award was kind of almost funny. I mean, I wasn't expecting that at all, but hey, anybody that wants to give me an award, that's fine. I think what the deal is that this subject is really very broad-based. It's not just U.S. education that's in trouble and very deep trouble. It's, multinational. For example, Swedish education used to be the best in the world. I remember when I was living in D.C. as a child, many parents would send their children to Switzerland or to France. I don't know, France has got kind of a bad reputation right now, but nevertheless, they sent their children to Switzerland or France for the best education if they really had a lot of money. Well, not anymore, because they're running into the same problems with very less substance than there used to be, a low rate of academics, and instead focusing on all the psychobabble of survival and coping skills, anger management, conflict resolution, self-esteem, sexual diversity, and all the rest of it. So this is a multinational problem in the entire free world, never mind the third world, but that's, I think, the reason that I mainly got the Human Rights Award. When I first started figuring out that something was very squirrely with education was in my college years. See, I went to a private international school, and I mean, we had ambassadors' daughters and sons and so forth, going to the school that I went to. It really was international for people who didn't speak English well, but could speak it, in fact. They learned it in their home country. And so it was very, very rigorous. And those kids knew they had to go back home and take the baccalaureate, the ones that were here from other countries, the ambassador's kids and so on. And so I got a very rigorous education. Well, then I went on to teach in the public school, and my training as a teacher was for public school. Everybody's training is that. But you know, I realized during my teacher training that schools were really not places where basics were being transmitted anymore, or literacy or proficiency at anything. Rather, the teacher was there to promote mental health. And I found that accountability meant satisfying government mandates and bureaucrats, and it was not answering to parents. So I started kind of doing my own thing and looking in these textbooks a little harder. And in fact, I got an A in my adolescent psychology course. Yeah, we take lots of psychology, lots of psych ed. They didn't care whether we knew anything about our particular subject or not, but lots of psych ed. And I went through my adolescent psychology book and got an A by itemizing every point of illogic I found there. And I figured I was going to wind up with an F for this. But the teacher gave me an A and explained that he'd never thought about it that way. Now that would never happen today. But at the time, this was on the crest of this new stuff coming in, so that's the way it worked out. And I knew then I was on to something, and when I went on to teach in the California public schools first and the Texas public schools second, and then I came back to Washington, my worst fears were, I realized they were absolutely on target.
Wow, so yeah, that sounds a lot like, there's a guy named John Rowland here in Austin who, if you go to constitution.org, you can read his corrections of the science and government and history textbooks that they use here in Texas, which most of the rest of the country uses whatever books we decide to use here in Texas because it's such a big market for it.
That's true. That's true.
He just went through and there's just pages and pages and pages full of errors.
Oh, yeah, and it's not just that. It's a lot of it is downright treasonous. A lot of it is made up. A lot of it is political correctness. In fact, I just did a seminar with Michael Chapman, with whom you may be familiar. He's in that Minnesota education, policy group, and he's, with a bunch of people who have really taken on the education establishment in Minnesota. And he did a presentation with me. It was part of a larger thing, constitutional issues and so on. But I must say he had one of the most powerful presentations I have ever seen, and he did a PowerPoint presentation with some of the highlighting, some of the comments and remarks and so on from various textbooks, mainly social studies, but also things like math that you'd think you couldn't fool around with that much. But nevertheless, the political correctness was stuck right into the math, into the literature, English literature, into, of course, social studies. That's to be expected. But it was worse than I had even imagined from a couple years ago when I was writing about the curriculum, per se, that nothing's been done.
You used the word treasonous. What exactly do you mean by that?
Say that, America did not do certain things that it did, and that it did do certain things that it didn't. I mean, it's imperialist. It starts wars. It's a terrible country. It discriminates against all kinds of people on the basis of race, age, sex, blah, 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 blah. I mean, everything is taken out of context and stuck in, almost as an afterthought. It's a bunch of afterthoughts strung together, pretending to be facts. And you find that both curriculum and testing is done on worldviews and feelings instead of on ensuring any kind of proficiency for anything. And the children flip from one activity to another, so there's no continuity between the skill bases. And these textbooks reflect that. There's a lack of intellectual honesty. What they're going for is the gut, the emotions. And I teach a whole seminar, or part of the seminar that I teach, I should say, a good part of it, is on how to derail groupthink and how to get your kids to recognize groupthink and to resist it when it's happening to them, especially in a school setting. And I don't mean just the peer pressure stuff. I'm talking about in the classroom lesson, because here, the group gets the dirty work done for the teacher, who functions as a change agent. The teacher functions as a provocateur, maybe that's a better way to put it. And they're encouraging socialism in the classroom. They do not focus on individual achievement or individual ability, such as reading on an individual basis or math on an individual basis or anything on an individual basis. It's a group grade. It's the group is everything, and of course you need peer pressure to do that. So when they say that they're trying to get kids to resist peer pressure, say for drug abuse and this kind of that and the other, that's just hogwash, because what they're doing is augmenting peer pressure whenever they can, so that the group is everything, and that if everybody's doing it, or if everyone's questioning certain things, or if everyone is not questioning certain things, then you get this mob mentality going, and that's how the modern classroom works. So it's really a terrible scandal in my view, and that's kind of what I've been focusing all my three books on, the last one being the most comprehensive one.
I have an anecdote about that very thing, the classroom setting of the whatever the group agrees on becomes what's right.
Uh-huh.
In fact, this was when I was in college at Austin Community College here in town, And they did a thing in, I guess it was the speech class, called Bomb Shelter, where we're all adults here, and,
yep.
and we all sit in this circle. And the thing is, there's six of us, and we're in a bomb shelter that only has enough air for five. And if we all stay, then we'll all die. And so we all have to decide who is to be sacrificed for the greater good of everybody else. And, of course, you're a policeman, and you're an environmental lawyer, and you're a very, very old black woman, and you're a little bitty baby. And so it's set up in a way where everybody decides, well, this 90-year-old black lady's lived a good life, and we'll go ahead and kick her out to die. And the funny thing is that I went and I brought it up with a literature professor that I had in another class, and he told me that his wife teaches kindergarten, and that she almost lost her job for refusing to play that game with the 5-year-olds.
Yes, sometimes it's called the lifeboat exercise. Everybody, you know, there's been a terrible mishap in an ocean liner, and everyone's on a life raft or trying to get on one, and they have to choose which one. We'll hold all the people, we'll say 10 people, 8 people, whatever, and they have to kick 2 or 3 out. This has been played many, many times, many different ways of playing that, but that's a staple. Now, it's starting to get a black eye because it's such a staple, and so they go to other things. But it's what I call therapy-style classrooms. They're encounter group classrooms. They're not the kind of classrooms that the adults who are over 40 who would remember, or even maybe over 35, but after that it becomes kind of iffy whether you've been exposed to this or not. But, for a long time, the grades have been group manufactured, and then for a long time you've had group exercises, group discussion, group all of that. But it's only been really lately that they're turning everything. I mean, you can see it even in the way the students are seated in the classroom, that the group has taken over and become, we're not a nation of individuals, we're a nation of group. It's groupism. And that has really kind of put the last nail in the coffin on education because, you know, why should anybody try to stand out? Why should anybody really try to succeed? And the only exceptions to that are in sports or in drama, and you know, your Hollywood types. They're the only ones who are really permitted an identity, so it's really not much of a surprise that people, or many of the kids, but even those who are not athletically inclined and those who have no acting ability, would gravitate there because they want to be an individual. That's pretty natural, but no, this is being pushed under. And instead, you're supposed to prefer the anonymity of a social group. And that's one of the big problems. Of course, you remember your parents probably telling you when you said, well, look, Mom, everyone's doing whatever it was that she didn't want you to do. Well, now that's gone out the window. When your parents said, hey, if everyone were jumping off a cliff, would you jump off too? I guess the preferred answer is yes.
Of course, if they told me to jump, then got to be part of the collective there. So
that's right.
I don't understand. Who's coming up with all this crap? Because it couldn't possibly be the local PTA that's writing this curriculum. So
no,
who is
they're helping now, but the people driving it, and that's one of the things I put in the book, there's a whole list, and primarily the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching is probably the biggest player, if I had to say who's on top of the heap here. But there are others, and they belong mainly to foundations. They're tax-exempt foundations, and they've gotten a tremendous amount of money. And many of them started in foreign countries. In fact, a lot of them came from, of all places, Scotland and Britain. And so we don't think of them as being our enemy, quote-unquote, but a lot of these really lunaticy type people, very psychology oriented type people, started out in Scotland and Britain, and they realized kind of belatedly in the 50s, actually before that, they realized that they could really get a lot of money with the way that we run our tax exempt 501c3s and so forth, our tax exempt foundations. and associations here. If you can bill yourself as an educational organization and not pay any taxes, or some other kind of organization and not pay any taxes, then that's, you know, good news for you, and you can get gobs and gobs of money that way. And then what you do is you build a spinoff. For example, the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching, their main spinoff was the Educational Testing Service. Well, that just, I mean, it makes multi-millions, I mean, I guess probably billions, into the billions of dollars. And that did quite well for them. But see, they separate it, and they say, well, you know, that's just our one of the organizations that we spawned. But there's a huge link between them, a philosophical link between them. And the board members are the same, and the presidents are board members of the other group. And, you know, they go back and forth, back and forth. The Aspen Institute for Humanistic Studies, that's another big one. And I noticed that Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching helps fund from time to time the Aspen Institute for Humanistic Studies. And they're probably the biggest religion-bashing, atheist lobbying organization in America. And they started really in their headquarters was in Berlin, but they opened a another in Aspen, Colorado, and they opened another chapter, or I guess you'd call it chapter, in Y, Maryland, and that's a suburb of Washington, D.C. I pass it every summer on the way to going to the beach in Delaware, and it's interesting that little Elian Gonzalez, who was picked up, you know, off the coast of Florida there, and he was put in the, they called it the Y Institute. They just called it the Y, W-Y-E is how it's spelled.
Oh, what?
The Y
building. This is where they had the peace agreement. Or
yeah, that's right.
One of the Bosch peace agreements. And I remember reading something about
it. Yeah, and it was the Aspen Institute. They're just, the why they don't call it what it is, I mean, they're just calling it the Y building or the Y Institute.
Well,
and even the conservatives are doing it.
Why did, after the national government seized that boy out of his uncle's house without a judicial order at all, why did they turn him over to the Aspen, or to the Y, whatever the hell it is?
They said they were going to broker a deal. And, you know, said he'd be safe there. But, of course, what they've been doing forever, I mean, ever since their inception, they run the American Humanist Magazine and so forth, is to promote ideals of the Humanist Manifesto, where the primary one is that there is no God. And they train journalists. In fact, if you're a journalist and you haven't been invited yet to be wined and dined by them, that is something you really want to do if you want to be a player and considered a real player in the journalistic community.
So they were basically getting this kid halfway ready to go back to Cuba.
Yes.
Here's a little bit of Cuba in Maryland to get you prepared to go back home.
That's it. That was it. And so they prepared the way for him. That was his holding tank, so to speak, until they go back.
I'm sorry, but you're saying about the journalists, though. I'm sorry.
The journalists are wined and dined. That's one of their biggest efforts. The Aspen Institute is to wine and dine journalists. And the Carnegie Foundation, which I said is one of the biggest players in this whole mess with the education system, they gave $650,000 in 1988 to if you want to call it the Y Institute. It's not the Y Institute. It's the Aspen Institute for Humanistic Studies. Some people just call it the Aspen Institute. They leave the of Humanistic Studies off. It's very interesting. You know, they're doing this for PR purposes. So, you know, this Carnegie Foundation also gave gobs of money to $100,000 in 1988 to People for the American Way, which is another religion-bashing institution. The ACLU, $200,000. I mean, there is so much money being traded back and forth by the Carnegie Foundation and then, of course, all its other entities. There's Carnegie Corporation, which, of course, is your banking and finance. There's the National Committee on Education and the Economy, Commission on Education and the Economy, that's Carnegie again. So that's your education again. They are doing so much. And their president, Ralph Tyler, was the head superintendent Well, I'm sorry, not superintendent. I misspoke there. He was the commissioner of education under health, education, and welfare before the Department of Education became a cabinet-level agency. And here he was at the same time president of the Carnegie Foundation. And he also created most of these tests, like the national assessment. And he put a bunch of psychological questions in there, which subsequently filtered down to the states who also have assessments, because that's part of the deal for them to get money from the federal government. They have to have an assessment too. And they call it an assessment for a reason, because it's not a test. It's focused on all this psychobabble and feelings and worldviews and attitudes and values. So there is a big effort afoot to change the values of a generation, for sure, two generations, one generation back, and they figure that by that time we will accept, our progeny will accept a socialist America, and we certainly are.
So do you think this assessment is to get a measure of how successful their propaganda is among
yes.
the kids?
Oh, yes, that's like, a big effort. In fact,
so they
most of
the socialism
test.
In the question, and then they make sure how you answer it. And see how
that's it. And no one question is going to make or break anybody. Now, don't mistake me there. What happens is that there are so many questions that taken together, you put all these together and then you enter the responses, because there's no right or wrong answer. There's a better answer and a worse answer, but not a right or wrong answer. You put all this stuff into a computerized model, and then this mathematical model, which is what a computer, of course, is made up of, is mathematical model. Is applied to all the responses, and from that they can do what's called predictive computer technology, which in effect tells the analyst what and how this child will probably react 5 or 10 years down the road to any particular hot button issue that might come up. And they're even asking such questions as, telling them to put on the front page of how many magazines or what books and magazines are in their home, and what TV shows they like, and where their favorite vacation spots are, and how long their parents spend in the home. And I mean, by the time you get through with this, they say that it's anonymous, or they pretend it's anonymous. What they say is it's confidential. Well, confidential in legal terminology does not mean anonymous. It means need to know. So it's not anonymous. Anybody can find out who this kid is because they've got coded, embedded identifiers in the test and in the answer sheets and all over the place. So all you have to do is grease the palm of somebody who wants that when this kid goes off and tries to enter into the college of his choice or enter into the career path of his choice. He may be blocked. And I'm already receiving many questions from parents. Saying this was really weird. Why was he turned down for this college? He had straight A's. He had great SATs. They had plenty of room. They had enough room certainly for 20 or so students. And this was not. But what they did is, by the time the oral interview came around, they had made up their mind because of all these things the parents believe, and then the kids maybe go along with it, and they can figure out. From all the things that the parents do and subscribe to. I mean, if he subscribes to, if a parent subscribes to 3 conservative publications and a religious publication, and says that going to church is important in their life, and then he answers all these what would you do if questions, and I will give you samples of those in a minute if you like, in a way that shows that he goes along with what his parents pretty much believe anyway, then there will be a letter coming back saying, well, we really thank you for your, for selecting us and for wanting to be in our school, but I think you'd be happier somewhere else. They don't say, we're turning you down. They do turn you down, but they say, we just think you'd be happier elsewhere. They don't make it quite so blatant. They soften the language, but the end result is the same. The same thing with employers. All this information is going into gigantic computers. All the computers talk to each other. I mean, for heaven's sakes, we're filling out warranty cards and putting our social security numbers on it. I mean, what do you expect? Of course, all the computers talk to each other. And they simply, it's called data brokering, it's called data mining, as you've heard that term, but there are information brokers out there that link this stuff together. But for education, it all goes into a computer called the Speedy Express, which stands for a very long term that we can get into in a minute. And it's an acronym, in other words. And then it goes into a computer database called WorkLink that automatically transfers this information to the workplace.
So, like on The Simpsons, when they joke about this is going in your permanent record, we all really do have a permanent record out there.
Yes. Yes.
See, I mean, I like to imagine that, sure, all the different little bits of information about me are all out there somewhere, but...
they do have to pull them together.
You're talking about it, these are all being merged into these single databases, and
right.
They're under the control of the education group, then, of the Carnegie types? Or
they can be. The Carnegie types are big players in this computerization stuff, but what I'm saying is that anybody who wants it simply goes to an information broker. The information brokers pull it together. So, you know, people think that there's just one big humongous, that if this ever happens, there'll be one big humongous computer bank out there. No. You don't need it. When all the computers have to talk to each other, the federal government has put out many monetary incentives to see that the computers are compatible with federal ones. So if you're going to do that, pretty soon it's going to be just like your Mac and your PC. People are going to say, well, gee, everybody's using a PC. I'm going to have to put that in my house, too. I mean, I may like Mac better, but I have to put a PC in here. Well, that's the way this works, too, is that if everybody, you know, can get online and get their information by having a compatible computer system software program, then you're going to get it. I mean, it's a no-brainer.
Well, and you say that this whole agenda is to turn America into a socialist country, and I think it's got to be pointed out that Carnegie was a tremendously successful capitalist, and that the establishment that runs America owned the biggest banks and the biggest corporations. So why would these capitalists be trying to push socialist education?
Well, that's a good question. What happened was the original guys aren't there anymore. They're long dead. And you have people that came and took it over. In fact, what I would do is say to answer that question, since it would take a long time to explain, is there was a book published called, let's see, I'm trying to think now, Not in the Public Interest, I believe, or something. I'll find it. I've got to look in the index of my own book to find out now exactly what the name of that book was. But it was somebody that was commissioned to write a book by the Carnegie Foundation themselves, to saying why this was a good thing. And it was kind of funny because she wound up, she did the book, she was commissioned to write the book, and she did a good job with it, but in her introduction, she started having second thoughts herself, and she said so, and they actually let her publish that. They printed it, that she questioned in her introduction whether it was really in the public interest or not that these things have been done. So what had happened is that, you know, people die, people replace, and people with a different philosophical bent take over many of these organizations, and that's really what happened.
Well, in scanning through the outline of your book, and from what I could find on the Internet, this kind of thing does go all the way back, doesn't it? I mean, the Rockefeller set up the General Education Board in the, 1910
right.
or something like that? And
the
Carnegie Endowment for International Peace was producing reports around, 1910, 1911, about collectivism and typical American efficiency.
And those were all, you know, different entities. I mean, just because their first name, for example, not the Rockefeller one, but the Carnegie ones, had the first name Carnegie, didn't mean they had the same people necessarily on every board. Some of it went back and forth, enough to keep the organizations together and trade gobs of money back and forth, but some of the bent and the mission of these various entities were different. Now, you mentioned the Carnegie Endowment. That's your foreign policy. So you start thinking about it. Here you have Carnegie's name on banking and finance, education, foreign policy, I mean, what else do you need? Not a lot.
No, not really. And the tax-exempt foundations, I guess you call them in your book, they're the buffer between policies and policy. And
correct.
They definitely have tremendous influence in, I mean, hell, you listen to National Public Radio, which is supposedly the left-wing liberal media, and every break, they're sponsored by the Rockefeller Foundation and the Rockefeller Brothers Fund and the Ford Foundation and the...
And, yep, that's the way it goes. And what I've done is to list, and I've got to find the page number here exactly, but I've listed every one of, as many as I can find of these organizations, the names that would pop up the most and mean the most to you. And a lot of it goes back to the Frankfurt School, too, in Germany. A lot of people came out of the Frankfurt School, and in fact, it became the Institute of Social Research, which had its home in Moscow. So, and then it moved, bought a brand new branch, you might say, to Columbia University, the home of Teachers College. So you really had a tremendous effort to infiltrate from various angles the a socialist mindset. Let's remember that Nazism and communism are not that far apart in their viewpoint. Their method of getting there was somewhat different. The Nazis wanted to improve the gene pool, and their method of doing that was to simply shoot the ones who didn't fit in. But the communists, the way they went about things was simply trying to win over everybody and changing everyone's mind or else, and causing as much chaos, social chaos, as possible. In other words, they did not want to weed out the criminals. They did not want to weed out all of these kinds of people that were setting societies on edge, because it was in their best interest to cause chaos. And suddenly, one day, when they start realizing that America was one of their targets, they got their heads together around 1971, and they said, wait a minute, we're doing this the wrong way. We need to join forces here. We want the same things. And that's really when it started going great guns, the Communist Party of the United States, and then, of course, the leftovers from the Nazi era that really many of them escaped problems over in Germany, but they came over here with the same philosophies and kept doing what they were doing. I mean, they may not have shot people, but they were big, big players in philosophically changing and inputting into policy positions. They had huge influence in public policy here.
So what happened in 1971 that this was the bringing together of the Nazis and the communists?
Well, what happened was basically... You had A.S. Neal with a Summerhill, A Radical Approach to Child Rearing, was published early in the 20s, and in the 60s he got a big boost from these guys. And then you had people that were protégés of the old Nazis, like Max Hallmann. He was one of the big movers and shakers, and he had a protege named Linda Erlingmeyer Kimling, and she decided that one of the best ways that they could do this, and she was really one of the people who made it swing, was to give tests to children to find out what their attitudes were, and more specifically, to see which ones were at risk for mental illness, quote unquote. And how she did that was getting our current, the popular ADD, attention deficit disorder, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, to be declared precursors of adult schizophrenia. So basically, anybody that has an accusation against them of mental illness, which of course ADD would be in that case, was watched. And that's how she could swing getting opinion-oriented questions into academic tests. because they were saying, well, you know, if people are given psychological tests, that's against the law, really, in the United States at that time, to just give a straight psychological test to somebody who doesn't need it. And, of course, you can always ask the question, does anybody need it? But, you know,
It should be pointed out that on that little psychiatrist chart, there's no checkbox for sane.
No.
Everybody's got something.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's it exactly. And so if she could swing this, this was really the what got the two parties together, the Nazis and the communists working together, was her brainstorm that if the mental hygiene movement, it brought together the mental hygiene movement, that could be used as the linchpin to get the tests, academic tests, focused in an opinion-oriented worldview direction. And then you would have what you needed, because you can't change any attitudes until you know what they are. I mean, that goes without saying. The only way that you can change any viewpoints on a massive scale is to know what they are in the first place. So something had to come along to be able to do that. And what came along was the testing mechanism, and that's still in place today.
Well, and now we're at the point where if they test you and they test your kid and decide that your kid needs pills, if you don't put the kid on the psychoactive drugs, then you can have your children taken away, right?
In many cases, that's the truth. Now there's a mighty movement now to turn that around, but it's been put on hold. I mean, there's all the pharmaceutical operations, of course, don't want that. I mean, they're making money off of this. So, you know, there's that little thing in there, too. But, yes, they want to give these drugs out because that's money for them. And what's happening, though, is that many parents, if they don't put their kids on psychological drugs, then first they're intimidated. That's number one. And if that doesn't work, sometimes they're told that the social service agencies will take their kids away. And, of course, they have to do some fancy footwork to get that to work sometimes, but especially in your recent immigrants and things like that, it's fairly easy to do because they're easily, scared into doing that type of thing, even though there may be nothing whatsoever wrong with your child. In fact, I mean, it's gotten to the point where if a parent decides that they want to, they don't want to give their child some horrible chemotherapy treatment, I mean, if the cancer has gone so far and they have a child with cancer, then they are penalized for not giving that kind of drugs and making him go through. I mean, if it's not in the child's best interest, who better to know it than the parent? It's not just a question of money. It's a question of can that kid can take that kind of abuse.
Well, but you're forgetting that the state knows best for everything and everyone at every time. And
that's right. Everyone's wired differently. Everyone's, you know, wired differently, as it were. And so, yes, there's a lot of things where children are being taken away from parents and are being intimidated in particular. You know, in other words, it's taken out on the kid in the classroom and in school on a daily basis if the parent does not put their kids on a psychotropic drug. And if the child is seen as not fitting in and that type of thing, or he's a nuisance, or he's, in fact, there's going to be a big article of mine in New American. It's coming out December 29th. I go into just exactly that. And so this is the kind of thing that's going on right now. In a book I call it, it's on page 187, Genetics, Child Labor, and Compulsory Education. And that's where I blend the three and show where this business in the 70s really brought it all together. The place where the right-wing eugenics movement of the Nazis and the left-wing Marxist anti-authoritarianism illiteracy movement kind of blended into one. And the first point was the assessment and high-risk testing was ostensibly aimed at locating these ADD, ADHD children who may supposedly become schizophrenic or mentally ill, And then, of course, your compulsory education means that every child has to go into this environment. Well, you know, that's well and good to say every child should be educated. But how every child is educated, if there are no private schools in your area and these schools are terrible, then there should be some way of getting out of them. But they're being roped in, even homeschoolers. You know, first they were leaving them alone, and now they know who they all are. And so it's becoming more and more difficult to homeschool and get your child into a college, a recognized college, because it's all about accreditation.
Oh, I see. Because I know the numbers of homeschoolers are going up, but I guess if you can't get into college after that, then that'll make you think twice.
Yeah, make you think twice. The numbers are still going up, which tells you something, that people are no longer intimidated. They're saying, fine, you take your accreditation and, you know, but they're also saying, my child is going to have some kind of foundation that he can work from, whether, you know, you consider it accredited or not. And, of course, there are good private schools. Not every parent is cut out to be a homeschooler, and I understand that. There are some very good private schools, especially here in D.C. and in the Eastern Corridor. You can find anything. I mean, we really and truly can. You can find conservative. You can find liberal. You can find structured. You can find unstructured. You can find creative. You can find whatever you want, religious. But, you know, you have to interview them as much as they're interviewing you. You have to know what you're looking for, and the first question you ask is, are you accepting federal funds? Because if they are, for any reason, I don't care if it's for their library or for handicapped bathrooms or for what it's for, that is going to start this kind of testing where they can find out everything about the child, and the child, as a result, is not in a position to change his mind. I mean, every child changes their mind about something. And if this is on record for posterity, whatever it is he said, then he doesn't have the luxury of changing his mind. Another typical type of question, or I should say, not a question, but an activity for children is, oh, go home and see what's in your parents' medicine cabinet. Write it down, bring it back to school, and we'll all talk about it.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
Isn't that just lovely?
In fact, I was going to say, because I did sort of make you skip past this earlier, I was hoping that maybe we could scare the hell out of the people listening a little bit more, and you could talk a little more about some of the activities, and besides just filling every kid's veins with Prozac, how else do they manipulate these kids in terms of, you know, scientific coercion, I think you call it in your book.
Right, scientific coercion. Well, basically, you have to understand that they're trying to get a certain set of values projected onto the child. And some of the questions that these kids get on their tests are not just tests, it's questionnaires. They're bombarded with questionnaires. They get a survey every 5 minutes. I mean, that's one of the problems. And it's called psychographics. And what psychographics is based upon race, creed, national origin, and all the rest of it, and it assumes that you're going to believe certain ways. And then they start taking stock and doing this to these kids. But what I'm saying is that a lot of the questions are so, I don't know how to describe it. They're so privacy invading. They're like psychological questions. And here, I'm going to give you a list here and I think you'll find this helpful, of the values they're trying to set onto your kids. And this is what I got faxed to me from a teacher in North Carolina. The values the kids are supposed to assimilate these days. Consensus is more important than principle. Flexibility is more important than knowledge. Nothing is permanent except change. The collective good is more important than the individual. There are no perpetrators, only victims. All ethics are situational. There are no moral absolutes. And there is no right or wrong, only conditioned responses.
You got me there with the whole collective is more important than the individual part.
Yeah, if that doesn't scare you, I don't know what will.
I mean, mean, yeah, this sounds exactly like what you described, where the Nazis and the communists come together is the greater good. Never mind inalienable individual liberty. There's only permanent change.
Right, right. This is it. And this is what you're working against every single day. And it's really shocking. Now, some of the questions that kids are asked, for example, the first phony baloney test I saw was in Pennsylvania. I've seen many, many more since. But you have a question here. I often wish I were someone else, or I get upset easily at home, and you're supposed to check, A, very true of me, B, mostly true of me, C, not true of me, D, not at all true of me, never true of me. Somewhat true of me and not at all true of me. And here's another one. You're asked to sit at a table with retarded students. In this situation, I would feel A, very comfortable, B, somewhat comfortable, C, slightly uncomfortable, D, very uncomfortable. And the same question is asked with religion. You're asked to sit at a table with a student of a different religion, or you're asked to sit at a table with somebody else, say someone who doesn't believe in abortion or whatever. And you're supposed to write down these responses to the question. Here's another one.
Understand, though. I mean, okay, if mm-hmm. if you and I are the graders of this test, or the
uh-huh.
we're the ones looking at the answer.
Now, you're not grading.
I'm not grading it, but
you're analyzing.
You and I are analyzing this, and we say, oh, well, Cindy here says that she would be very comfortable sitting at a table of retarded kids. So
mm-hmm.
what? I mean, what if...
Okay, one question. Remember what I said at the beginning. One question isn't going to make or break anybody. It's the totality of the questions that point to a belief system. And when you have that belief system in place, then you can start these courses and say, okay, I'll give you an example. Every teacher has to go to their friendly computer. They say you're an English teacher. Okay, you go to your friendly computer and you type in English. And it's the regional computers that only the teachers use. And someone comes along and says, look, the tests this year indicate that your students in XYZ school district are really bad on tolerance. They just have a tolerance problem. And so you also type in English then. The teacher types in English and tolerance. And pretty soon out spits all these homosexual curriculums. And without even... how they're looking at them first, the teacher thinks that because the computer has spit out these curriculums, that means they're approved. Well, they are, sort of. They're in a database that was accepted by the Joint Dissemination Review Panel and goes into the National Diffusion Network because the program supposedly was successful somewhere. Nobody defines successful, but I'll tell you what successful means. It means that it worked. So if it was successful in changing attitudes and viewpoints somewhere, then you can assume that it probably worked somewhere. So the teacher says, oh, okay, here's a film or film strip or whatever on homosexuality, like That's Elementary, and you know, people may have heard of that one. That's one of the new ones that are coming down the pike that are being shown in all the elementary schools. And it's about two lesbians. It, you know, talks about that and other homosexual activities. And it legitimizes them. Okay, fine.
Well, that's not too big of a deal, except that we're talking about very young kids here. We're not talking about, you know, eighth grade or ninth grade kids.
We're talking young. Now, sometimes it is the older ones, too. I mean, I'm not exempting them. I'm just saying that this process starts rather young. But you see, in order to get a hard-heading curriculum on homosexuality, you first have got to establish whether you need that or not, and whether the kids are, quote, intolerant, unquote. And the only way you can do that is by testing and surveying and questioning. So that's why you've got all these health questionnaires, which are really sex questionnaires. I mean, what kind of question is, what do you think about when you think about sex? Well, that's what they're getting in Nebraska, eighth graders. I mean, this is the kind of question they're passing for tests, and they're snuck in there.
What does the No Child Left Behind Act do about this? Just make it all worse?
I'm afraid so, because nobody's looking at the quality of the tests themselves. They're not, you know, they're saying testing of reading and math and science for, you know, certain grades. Okay, that's fine. But who is examining the tests themselves? I told you that a lot of these oddball questions, the worldview questions, are snuck into everything including math, which where you wouldn't think anything could be snuck in. But they are. Michael Chapman did a really good presentation on that, showing just where the questions were. I wish I had that right in front of me right now to show you. But I've seen them too. I just can't rattle them off the top of my head right now. But there are bunches of them, and he has them, you know, chapter and verse. Michael Chapman in Minnesota, you really ought to look him up, have him on your show, because he could read those questions right off to you. And then they find out where the kids are. Well, if there's a trend, an identifiable trend in the district, then they can put this stuff in under the umbrella of these children need tolerance, training and tolerance, or whatever it happens to be that's their pet thing of the moment. It's like if one person has a headache, let's give everyone an aspirin.
Okay, well, I can't think of the slightest solution to this besides just completely abolishing all government schools and
turning. It's gone really too far at this point. It has. The public school, keep in mind, maybe this is good news. It's kind of good news, bad news. The public school is imploding. It has finally gotten so dangerous because of the lax discipline and the laxity of, or I should say the lack of substantive learning, and all of this hoopla and this navel-gazing, if you will, where everything is aimed at how you feel instead of whether you know anything, the school is imploding. The public school is really about to just bust wide open, and it's become dangerous to even send a child there. Very dangerous.
Well, do you advocate trying to reform the public schools and decentralize them more, or do you just encourage people to homeschool?
I think at this point you almost need to find a private school or homeschool pronto, because it is dangerous. I mean, kids are sent to school looking like pimps and whatever, and, you know, hookers and whatnot. The whole business of this peer pressure starts right on the school bus before it even gets off and into the classroom. The whole environment of the school is so bad that really kids, A, start hating school. And once a kid hates school, it's really hard to get him interested again.
Right, because
especially
hates,
in learning.
He hates education, not...
I'm sorry?
Well, because the kid doesn't distinguish between hating school and hating learning.
Right. They don't. And they don't.
So
that's
you decide
the problem.
You hate one and you hate the other, too.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Because remember, we're talking about a child's mind here, not an adult that can distinguish between things. And some kids, of course, if they're very bright, they aren't in spite of the system. They just pick it up. They walk around and figure it out. And that's great. But think how much more they could do if the school was really based and focused on those things that would make him proficient in something. And unfortunately, he's at the mercy of a whole lot of things that are more make or break than a grade point average. What's going to make or break him is his viewpoints and attitudes, and that's not good at all.
Yeah, when you brought up the self-esteem thing, I thought of something I saw, and I don't know, it was probably John Stossel in 2020 a few years back or something.
Uh-huh.
They had this, I think it was an international math test, and they brought all these kids together, and the teachers were doing their own little experiment besides the math test, and one of the teachers said right before the test, okay, so who's going to do great on the test today? And how all the South Korean kids and the Japanese kids and everyone, especially the Asians, but also the Europeans, all kind of looked down and were nervous and, oh, no. And all the American kids' hands went in the air and they said, me, I'm going to do great, yeah. And how the Americans did the worst on the test out of everybody in the whole world. How everyone did great on the math. Except the Americans, and how the Americans were the only ones with any self-esteem.
Well, you know, the international, I believe it's math and science test, that's given all about every 3 years, they do one of these, and it is international. And it's the real thing. They don't have a lot of these squirrely questions on them. And I think the United States came third or fourth or fifth from the bottom. of all the countries of the world. I mean, at the time, Serbia, which had just undergone all this wrenching warfare and everything, did better than we did. I mean,
you know, the solution is the federal government's got to do something about it.
That's it. and that's the bait. You see, if you keep giving things like that, then everybody's squealing for the federal government to continue to do something, and that's exactly the wrong way to do it. The people who don't know the scoop and don't know how government operates and don't know what's been done in the past, they don't realize that schooling today is not about literacy or basics or proficiency at anything, that what school is about is mental health. Once they get that into their head, then what's happening or not happening starts to make sense. You know, the quantum leap in technology over the last 5 years, the average citizen isn't going to know how to counter a computerized psychological attack mechanism, which is what we've got going here, unless they really understand a little of the history here and how it feeds in to the legislation and so on. And that's what my book basically is about. It gives a person enough background, not everything, of course, but enough background, and I really like to get books, you know, I do a lot of book signings, and I love to get the ones where people have underlined and dog-eared their book, because that tells me that they really are getting this stuff.
Right, that's got to make you feel good.
Yeah.
All right, everybody, Beverly Aikman, she's the author for Educating for the New World Order, Microchipped, How the Education Establishment Took Us Beyond Big Brother, and Cloning the American Mind, Eradicating Morality Through Education. We'll be sure to look forward to your article in the New American Magazine coming up, next month?
It's coming out December. That's this month, 29th. And I have another article coming out in Chronicles Magazine in the January issue, which will also be accessible in December, later this month. So I do a lot of that kind of writing. And, of course, the book Cloning of the American Mind, of my three books, Cloning of the American Mind is really the most comprehensive, because I wrote it because people wanted something more comprehensive after I did the other two. So I finally just, you know, rolled up my sleeves and said, okay, I guess I'm going to do it. But you've got to know things about hidden identification techniques like barcoding and sticky labeling that are on these tests so that they can find an individual kid if they want to. You've got to know how drug and alcohol surveys subtly convey the notion that even wine with the evening meal is the same as cocaine and drunkenness. I mean, how health questionnaires grill students on sexual practices and how they imply that unmarried sex is expected and normal. And, you know, you really need to understand how this stuff works.
Too much argument about that one around here.
No, you wouldn't, but you need to know how they do it.
Right.
You know, it's not just that they're doing it.
Right.
How are they doing it?
All right, everybody. The book is Cloning of the American Mind. The author is Beverly Aikman. Thanks a lot for coming on the show today. Sure appreciate it.
My pleasure.